Yes.
Students could meet together.
Oh, without me there?
Yeah.
Hey, then you can't meet in my office then. So I don't know how it works around here. That's a good idea.
Undergrad student having a formal way of getting help from graduate students or.
Sure, and then you could just meet again on Thursdays in the usual place, since there's a whole room reserved for this.
Oh, there is, okay.
Yeah, so.
So if you just tell us that room, we could go there.
Okay, I like that better too. Because my personal experience with taking classes is that the most valuable thing of all is trying to convince other people of your homework solutions being correct. And the arguments that arise from that can be very useful. I remember extremely heated discussions like this when I took algebraic geometry once. Students only. So it's this building, and I think it's. Are we in 201 now? So whatever.
We're in 201.
Okay, then I think it's 207. It says on the syllabus.
Okay.
And I'll just double check here.
How many undergrads are still registered for the class, though? Or all four still registered, or just two? Because you've been all in two for the last 2 years. And I can't make Thursdays, so it's kind of.
You can't make Thursdays? Oh.
Oh, well, then.
What about a slightly different timeline? Well, I don't have the room. Other times.
No, but we can find another room to meet in that
side. Okay, maybe I'll let you organize it amongst yourselves.
Okay. So why don't we? Well, I mean, it's kind of a priority with undergrad.
Tuesdays are really good for everybody in the class, so.
Is that
really?
Yeah.
So Tuesday's good for both of you?
Mm-hmm. So what about Tuesdays, same time but Tuesday? Right after my office hours.
Sounds good.
Okay, cool. So it'll be. Now, I'll have to redo this, so I don't know where.
Yeah, we'll figure out.
This is a big question. Section, location, you'll have to figure it out. I mean, one possibility is there's a room, a big room right across the hall from my office. That might be. Probably it's available. It's a nice room.
I don't know.
Then if you get really annoyed, you can run over and ask me a question. Okay, so that's section. I went to start a grad student number theory seminar where only grad students speak, and I proposed the time 12 to 1. And I know this is right after the topology seminar, and that people often go to lunch at 12 to 1. So it would be a seminar which you would be encouraged to either bring your lunch or I would get pizza and have it there for free available to people to come to the seminar or something like that. And then you would be the speakers.
On what day?
On Tuesday from 12 to 1. Mainly I'm suggesting the time and providing what sort of faculty support I can, but I think Greg would be the main organizer of the seminar as far as figuring out who talks and so on. So what do you guys think of that time, or does it clash with something? You have a
I can't wait that time.
Yeah.
Okay, so what about when the 2 on Tuesday? Is that better? Okay. So the only thing for me is I think often there are faculty meetings at 1:30, but then I could just duck out a little early. Or just show up to the faculty meeting a little bit. So tentatively, let's say Tuesday 1 to 2. I'll check on getting a room for this. How many people here would be interested in speaking in a seminar? 1, 2.
Are we going to set up something to kind of a book to read together, or? A paper to read, or are we going to do random talks?
Well, both. Yeah. Whatever Greg decides, he's in charge. You can find out what people want to do in the long run. Okay, so grad student number 3 seminar looks like 1 to 2, Tuesdays. Okay. And make sure you sign the email address sign up sheet. Okay, so I think that's all announcements. And okay, so what I'm going to do today is talk about these notes that I handed out. Notes? Does anybody not have a copy of the notes? Does anybody not have a copy of the homework? There's one other copy of the notes. No, actually, here's a better copy of the notes. It's
stable. Thank you.
Yeah. All right, so I now the course is going to get a little bit more formal than it was last week, and you should actually be worried if you don't understand something. Whereas last week, if you didn't understand something, that was great. That was perfectly fine. This week, get really worried. So it's just a little different. Last week, don't be worried at all. Okay, so first, an elliptic curve. Over a field K. So examples of fields we often consider elliptic curves, the rational numbers, the complex numbers, the real numbers, the integers modulo P, which is a finite field of order P, finite fields of order P to the n. Fields like this, fp of t, these are rational functions in t over a finite field, etc. You know, these are just examples of fields. But elliptic curve over a field k is a projective curve defined by an equation y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b with minus 16 where a cubed plus 27 b squared not equal to 0. So this definition has a slight problem. For example, there will be no curves in elliptic curves in characteristic 2 under this definition. So in a special case when the field has characteristic 2 or 3, instead of considering this restrictive of an equation, you want to consider a slightly less restrictive equation. So in general, so when I say characteristic, what's the characteristic of a field? That's the additive order of 1. So in some fields, for example, the integers modulo p, 1 is equal to p. No. 1 is equal to p plus 1, or p times 1 is equal to 0. So that means that fp has characteristic p. Whereas in the rational numbers, there's no number, so that number times 1 is equal to 0, and that number is, there's no non-zero number, so that number times 1 is 0. So these have characteristic 0, and this one has characteristic p, and this one has characteristic p also, and this one has characteristic p. So fields either have characteristic of prime number p or 0. Yes?
That's kind of a random algebra question.
Sure, please.
Is there any way that R reals arise algebraically?
Right. No, they're not algebraic. They're a completion of with respect to evaluation, so,
yeah, so
I don't think so.
Algebraic, but I guess that.
Well, I don't really understand your question, but they're not countable, so I doubt you're going to just construct them up via some sort of simple procedure starting with Q. And also, R is not an algebraic extension of Q because it's transcendental elements. So, if by algebraic way to get to something, you mean you start with a so-called prime field, i.e., Q, or a finite field FP, and then you try to join things that satisfy an algebraic equation, you'll never get to R because R has elements that are transcendental, such as pi. Or E. But the best way to think of R is it's got via completion. There are a lot of other fields that are very interesting. Number theory got via completions, namely the chaotic fields QP. These have characteristics 0. They're exactly the analogs of R, except with a different metric on the rational numbers and you complete. We won't use these at all in this class, but we're throwing these into the mix. And then there are finite extensions of these. You can take the completion of the algebraic closure of QP and you get something called CP, which is the analog of the complex numbers, but it sort of has a different structure. It's actually abstractly isomorphic to the complex numbers, but it has a different topology on it. Different notion of open sets. So if the characteristic is 2 or 3, then We also have to consider equations of this form, y squared plus a1 xy plus a3y equals x cubed plus a2 x squared plus a4x plus a6. But for the rest of today and really the rest of the week, I won't consider this case at all, so it won't be a problem. I don't have to worry about that extra more general form. But if you do this, then you can get cubic curves that have the same sort of properties as the elliptic curves we'll talk about today, and they exist at least in characteristic 2. And from the point of view of actual applications in cryptography, this is a very important case, because if you use an elliptic curve to make a crypto system, it's very popular to use characteristic 2, since on a computer, implementing arithmetic modulo 2 is very efficient, whereas implementing arithmetic modulo prime p may be less efficient. So this is the definition of an elliptic curve, and let's see what is confusing here. So there's this word projective curve. So so the thing is, you don't want to identify the elliptic curve with the set of solutions to this equation, or with just the curve in the plane defined by this equation. There's an extra point on the curve at infinity, and it's important not to leave that out. So that's what I mean by the projective curve defined by that equation. So I think I should say something a little more formal about that. But it involves some topology. But just in words, this equation defines a set of points in the plane, the set of solutions to that equation. The plane, let's just say for a moment, the complex plane, is a subset of some slightly bigger space called the projective plane. The projective plane, it's sort of like the plane along with an extra line at infinity, and there's a topology put on this object. And if you take the solution set to this curve, to that equation, it'll intersect this line at infinity in exactly one point. So by the projective, it looks like it would intersect at two points, but these are actually the same point. This thing's kind of twisted in a funny way. Algebraically it's very clear, but then you get the same picture. So the elliptic curve, it's the algebraic object defined by that equation, plus remembering that there's one extra point at infinity. So you really need to learn a bit about projective geometry to make precise sense of that. It's okay to just define the elliptic curve to be something given by an equation like this, and then say an elliptic curve is given by an equation like that. So that's what I'll do. All right, given an elliptic curve, there are a whole bunch of... Oh, are there any questions about the definition of an elliptic curve? So this is a sort of an engineering definition almost. It's just something given by giving two numbers, A and B and K. I forgot to mention that A and B are elements of K. That satisfies some condition. It doesn't have sort of an abstract feel to it, really. Yes?
Why the condition? Where does that come from?
Well, the thing that makes elliptic curves really interesting is you can put a beautiful algebraic group structure on them. If you don't require that condition, as you might discover if you do problem 2, then you're not able to put a group structure on the set of all solutions to the equation of a given field. So it just won't work. The group operation won't work. What happens if this condition is violated? Well, then you have a multiple root, and if you draw the graph of that equation, when this number, which is called the discriminant, if this is zero, so delta equals zero, then you get two possibilities. The graph could look like this, and this is what's called a cusp, or the graph could look like this. And this is a note. So notice all I'm doing here is imagining graphing this polynomial and then taking the square root of that graph, so to speak, and then reflecting it back over the x-axis. So this would be the case when, by the way, if the discriminant is 0, then the cubic on the right-hand side has a double root or a triple root.
So the cubic has double or triple root. So if you imagine graphing
if you imagine graphing this equation, then you'll find in the case of a triple root that the graph looks like this, and in the case of a double root,
here's where the double root would be,
the graph looks like this. And in each case, the nice property that a line intersects the curve in exactly 3 points isn't true anymore. If you draw this graph when delta is not equal to 0, then if you consider points in the projective plane over the algebraic closure of your base field, then any line will intersect the curve in exactly 3 points. Whereas here, that's not the case. Can anybody think of a line that does not intersect this first graph in exactly 3 points? This one. And what about in this case? Again.
So that's tangent to the graph at a point, or?
This one's. So there's a multiplicity here, but I don't think it comes out to be right. I think it's the multiplicity is still wrong. I need to think about that.
In a regular, if you have no other requirements in mind, about a line parallel to the x-axis, like for that one, for the
yes.
curve.
Yes.
Just a line parallel to the x-axis.
Like this.
Yeah.
It actually intersects in 3 points, but 2 of the points are not defined over the real numbers in that picture. It's just that if you try to find the actual 2 other intersection points, you end up solving a system of 2 equations. One of the equations is here, and the other equation is the equation of your line. Your line is maybe y equals minus 1. When you try to solve those 2 equations, you end up with 1 equals this cubic, and then you have a cubic, and you want to find the roots of that cubic. One of the roots is visibly real. It's the x-coordinate of this intersection point. There are 2 other roots to that cubic, and there's no reason they have to be real numbers. But they will be numbers in the algebraic closure of real numbers, namely the complex numbers. So you can solve your cubic over the complex numbers. You'll find the other 2 roots, and that's where the other 2 intersection points lie. Whereas here you have a problem, because you're not going to find some other intersection point somewhere else. And even with counting multiplicity, it doesn't work out. These are just pictures that illustrate what goes wrong. And when I define the group law formally, you can see more precisely in one of these examples how it simply doesn't work and you don't have a group. Okay, so the next thing is to precisely define a group structure on an elliptic curve. Whereby an elliptic curve, L henceforth means something given by an equation of this form. However, you can define everything in this more general setup, and the formulas simply become more complicated. And we won't need that, though, if you are going to become an engineer and start implementing stuff, you would definitely want to think about that more general form. So I'm going to do things a little bit backwards. I'm going to write down an explicit formula, completely algebraic explicit formula that takes as input 2 points on the curve and gives you a 3rd point. And then, it'll be a fairly simple formula. In the notes you can see it on page 105. And then I'll explain to you geometrically what that formula represents and prove that it in fact represents what I say geometrically. So the other alternative would be for me to describe geometrically how to add 2 points. You take 2 points, you draw a line, look at the 3rd point of intersection, etc. And I did mention that last time. But I think the algebra, if you just write down the answer and then verify it, the algebra is a lot simpler than trying to derive the answer. from the geometric picture. So that's why I'm going to just write down the formula.
And then verify that it works, give you a geometric interpretation of it. Okay, so here's what you do. This is a procedure that would be very easy to program on a computer. And it does the following. It takes two points, P1 and P2, that are on the elliptic curve over field K. So here, this notation E of K means the set of pairs X, Y, that are in K, that satisfy the equation of the curve. And you throw in one extra point at infinity. So if you have two points like this, I'll tell you how to obtain a third point, which I'll call P3 equals P1 plus P2. Questions? Can I help somebody? Unless it's irrelevant to the first. Okay, so input, output. And here's how it works. There are a few special cases, which we take care of right at the beginning. In the notes I call this O instead of infinity, so I'll switch to calling it O. And you can set everything up where O is actually any point on the curve that has coordinates in K. But the formulas are simplest if you choose it to be this extra point off at infinity. Okay, so here's how it works. Step one. If one of the two points is O, if P1 equals O, then P3 is just P2, and you're done. And if P2 is O, then P3 equals P1, and you're done. So O is the neutral element of the group. This will be the identity element of the group. Step one. Step two. In the picture, P1 and P2 are right above one another, so they're symmetric about the x-axis, then the answer is O. So P3 is O. So if let's write P1 equal to x1, y1. These are just the coordinates of P1 and P2. If x1 equals x2 and y1 equals minus y2, then p3 is O. So these are negatives in this group operation. The point x, y, the point x minus y are negatives. So step two. So in each of these cases, you're done. Can you check here to denote you're done? You figure out what p3 is. That's it. Okay, next. So now you're in neither of these two special cases, so now you have to do something else. So let's let lambda be the following number: 3x1 squared plus a over 2 times y1, if p1 is equal to p2, and if p1 isn't equal to p2, it's y1 minus y2 over x1 minus x2. So again, secretly, to keep in mind that there's some geometry going on here, this is just the slope of the line that is determined by P1 and P2. And in the limiting case, when P1 is equal to P2, this is the slope of the tangent line at the point P1. Okay, so that's lambda, and finally you get the answer. So P3 is given by the following formula. It's lambda squared minus
x1 minus x2. So the square of the slope that we computed minus the two x coordinates. And minus lambda x3 minus nu, where here x3 is just the x coordinate we just found, and nu is equal to y1 minus lambda x1. And the reason I wrote it as x3 is that once you've done the work to compute this number, it's nice to be able to just, you know, to save that work in the step of computing the y-coordinate instead of having to redo that work. So I could have just, you know, put this here, but then I would de-emphasize the fact that you can save yourself some work. So that's P3. So that's the group operation. So it's as simple as that. Given two points, there are a few special cases, and then there's the general case, and this is the sum of the two points. So if you're, you know, asked to implement that on a computer, even a handheld calculator probably wouldn't be incredibly difficult, since it's really just a formula. It's not as simple as, say, adding two vectors in a plane where you just add the two coordinates, but it's not that much more complicated. Unfortunately, it's extremely unclear from the definition I've just given you that you get a group from this. So there are various axioms that a group has. One thing that is clear from the formula, though, is the following. Suppose that you take two points, like we've done, and their coordinates are in K. What about the third point? Where do its coordinates lie?
In K.
In K again, because you haven't extracted any roots of any step in this. You just wrote down a simple algebraic formula in terms of the original coordinates. So you don't get any square roots or signs or anything popping up. It's just some number that's expressible again in terms of the numbers you start with, which is very nice. And you can take any curve again and take any k you want that for which any bit field that's slightly bigger than k, for example, an L that contains k, and then you get a group from it. You get a set of elements, the solutions, plus there's this way of combining them together. So let me reinterpret this geometrically a little bit more formally. So geometric interpretation. Oh, one quick question. Why do you not have to worry about y1 being 0 here? Right, it's taken care of by case 2. If p1 equals p2 and y1 is 0, then in fact you're in case 2 because p1 equals p2, so x1 equals x2, y1 is 0, so y1 equals minus y2, so you're in case 2. So that doesn't happen, there's no division by 0 occurring here. Okay, so now the geometric interpretation. So there's a good picture in the notes on page 107 at the top, which has an illustration of an elliptic curve, which is very accurately drawn, so it's not some fake graph of an elliptic curve. And I have two points on the curve, 0, 2, and 1, 0, and you draw the line with slope lambda determined by p1 and p2. And it intersects at the point 3 minus 4, and you reflect this about the x-axis. And you get the point 3 comma plus 4, so 3 minus 4, and this is P3. So this is the miraculous third point that you get from the first two. Via this procedure, notice again that you start with two points, the entries lie in the rational numbers, and the third point has the property that the entries lie in the rational numbers. Does this work if you restrict to a ring? If you have points and their coordinates are in a ring, and you apply this group operation, do the resulting points lie in the same ring again?
It may not be 2y, may not be.
Yeah, exactly. You can easily fail that 2y is invertible or that this is invertible. In fact, that's usually what happens. So, it doesn't work for a ring, but it does work for a group. I mean, for a field. Well, you could be worried about characteristic 2 here, but these formulas are only valid when the elliptic curve is given by an equation of the form I gave, and there are no elliptic curves in characteristic 2 of that form. So, there's no problem here. The characteristic is not 2. So now the geometric interpretation of the group operation is you take your two points, you draw the line that connects them, you find the third point of intersection, then you reflect about the x-axis. That's it, geometrically. Okay, so let's prove that that's right. So we'll take two points, P1 and P2, as in the formula here, two points. And I'll just prove that this is correct in the case when P1 is not equal to P2. So let's assume, for simplicity, that P1 is not equal to P2. And consider the line. Let's write down the equation of the line that they determine and intersect it with the curve. We'll find that P1 and P2, of course, are in that intersection, but then there'll be one third point. And we just need to verify that it's this point right here, except reflected about the x-axis, which just amounts to changing the sign of the y-coordinate. So let's just assume this. In a limiting case, when they're equal, then it just switches to this. So you have to do a little calculus to find that. Okay, so let's see. The slope of the line, so the slope of the line through P1, P2 is lambda equals, it's exactly that, y1 minus y2 over x1 minus x2. And now let's write down the line that goes through those points. Maybe I'll do it right here. So it's y equals the slope, y1 minus y2 over x1 minus x2. X plus some number that goes here. And we know this line has to go through the point y1, y2, and through the point x1, x2. So we can figure out what that point has to be. I'm just going to multiply through by x1 minus x2. So to figure out the equation of a line, I just need to figure out what goes there. So if I plug, if I substitute, I mean, I have it written down my notes. I'll just write it down. And this is pretty elementary. So the very simple equation for the line is, when you simplify things, y equals y1 plus x minus x1 times lambda. So let's just verify that in fact is a line that goes through x1, y1, and x2, y2. So it's the equation of a line, and because it's linear, and if you substitute y equals y1 and x equals x1, you get 0 here, so these are equal. And if you substitute y equals y2 and x equals x2, you get y2 equals y1 plus x2 minus x1 lambda, and that's just the formula that defines lambda. That is equivalent to the formula that defines lambda. So that's the equation of the line. There it is. So now you intersect that with the elliptic curve, which is just some geometry. So you have the equation of the elliptic curve, y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b. The equation of the line, which is y equals y1 plus x minus x1 lambda, where lambda is the slope. And now you intersect the two, so you solve simultaneous equations. So I'm substituting y into the top, so you have y1 plus x minus x1 lambda squared plus x cubed plus ax plus b. And now if you were to multiply everything out, don't actually do it, but if you multiply everything out and set it equal to 0, you have a cubic equal to 0. And the question is to find the solutions to that cubic. And we know that two of them have to be the x-coordinates of p1 and p2, since those x-coordinates of p1 and p2 lie on the line and on the curve. So we have to figure out what the third solution to the cubic is. So let's not multiply the whole thing out. Let's just get started. So we'll find x cubed plus the coefficient of x squared, and then we won't worry about the rest of it. So I'm going to write down an equivalent equation, but I'm just going to find the coefficient of x squared. The reason I'm only finding the coefficient of x squared is because I know two roots of a cubic, and I want to find the third. And if you look at the formula x minus alpha, x minus beta, x minus gamma equals x cubed minus alpha plus beta plus gamma x squared plus lower order terms, you see that if you know the coefficient of x squared and you know two of the roots, then you can find the third root easily. And that's what we'll do. So we just have to figure out what the coefficient of x squared is here. So there's no contribution at all on the right-hand side. On the left-hand side, we have, looks like lambda squared. I think that's it. Sorry. So it's on the inside, it's x times lambda plus some constant, and then when you square that, you get x squared lambda squared. So it's just lambda squared. So now what we have is that this is also equal to x cubed plus minus x1 minus x2 minus x3 times x squared plus the lower order terms. And these two have to be equal. Because again, the three solutions to this cubic are the three x coordinates of intersection between the elliptic curve and the line. So now you equate, you get lambda squared equals minus x1, minus x2, minus x3, and solve for x3. You get x3 equals something wrong. Seems like the signs wrong.
It's minus the trace.
Minus. Oh, right. Sorry.
About 1 line, though, yeah. Minus the trace times x squared.
So.
Minus
lambda squared.
So you have minus lambda squared equals minus x1 minus x2 minus x3. The formula is x cubed minus the trace times x squared.
Right, that's correct. I agree with that. But the trace is x1 plus x2 plus x3.
So you
want to plot neither? Yeah, but I'm just equating it. Mm-hmm. It's something really stupid.
Oh, yeah, that is.
Maybe this is wrong. Actually, no, that's right.
So I'm saying that should it be x cubed minus, should it be a negative instead of?
Right here?
Should it be a minus?
That could very well be. Oh yes, because look, this is on the left-hand side, that's on the right-hand side. So when I multiply this out, I have to take it to the other side. That fixes it, and then here you have minus that, so you get plus that, and then it's exactly as claimed. Excellent. Okay, excellent. So we have this formula. And then if you want the other part, you just substitute in, you have y is equal to this, y equals y1 plus x minus x1 lambda, and so y3 equals y1 plus x3 minus x1 lambda, and we know x3 now. And I guess I've just written, well, we just need to check that this is equal to minus lambda x3 minus nu. And does that look okay? You have my, so I think it's another sign problem. What can that be? Okay. Signs backwards again. Hmm. Oh, remember this is the third point of intersection, and I still have to reflect it about the x-axis. So I've just found the y-coordinate of the third point of intersection. So the question is this equal to the negative of what I claimed is the y-coordinate of the point after reflecting about the x-axis? And in fact, it is. Yes. So the y-coordinate of this third point of intersection is exactly the negative of what you get from this formula. So that's the group operation. You take two points, you draw the line, get the third point of intersection, then you reflect. And in formulas, this is it. It's, at least if your curve is given by y squared plus x cubed plus ax plus b, it's given by this simple formula in terms of these. Now, questions that arise are, you know, why do you get a group? Why is it commutative and so on? The commutativity is, let's see, it's fairly clear from the formulas. Here, if you switch P1 and P2, it doesn't make any difference because they're equal. Here, if you switch P1 and P2, that switches the sign of both the numerator and denominator. And here, it switches this around. So again, it doesn't make any difference except maybe here. But well, it doesn't matter. We don't have to use the formulas to verify commutativity. We can just think about what we did algebraically. We found this point by taking these two points and finding the third point of intersection. It really doesn't matter at all in which order you do this. You can you get the same line if you switch the order here. So you get something that's commutative, then there's associativity. So there's an issue there. So associativity is difficult to show. There are three different viewpoints on how you might think about why the group law is associative. One way is you could program a computer, and this isn't impossible. You can program a computer to just take three points P, Q, and R. Where you view P, Q, and R as having coordinates x1, y1, which are somehow polynomials. x1 and y1 are indeterminates. And then Q has indeterminate polynomial values, x2 and y2, and R has indeterminate values, x3 and y3. And then you require that y1 squared is equal to x1 cubed plus ax plus b, and so on. So you have to work modulo some relations. Then you just program this formula into the computer, you work it out, and you compute P plus Q plus R, and P plus Q plus R, and you wait a long time until the computer finds the answers and writes them in a canonical form, and you find that you get the same thing. So that would be one way to get at least a computer to be convinced that the group law is associative. Another way is to do some geometry. So this is described very nicely in Silverman and Tate in chapter 1, section 2. And there you draw a big diagram that illustrates this and illustrates that. And then you understand very well some facts from geometry. In particular, the key thing that they use is that if you have if you have two cubic, actually, I don't want to get this wrong, so I'm just going to show you the picture. So I draw a big picture like this. And they actually explain very well what is meant by this picture. But the key idea is that if you have two cubic curves, then they'll intersect in exactly 9 points by Bezout's theorem. You have to count multiplicities correctly. You have to count, you know, points over the algebraic closure. But if you do that, then two cubics intersect at 9 points. And a fact you can prove by counting dimensions, by some dimension counting argument, is that if you have a third cubic that intersects 8 of those 9 points, it also has to intersect the 9th point. So they illustrate that with this picture right here. But basically, they set up this big picture, which you can probably, well, it's a small picture to you, but there's one cubic, which is the cubic curve, which defines, you know, the elliptic curve. There are two other cubics, which are the union of the three lines that are solid and the union of the three lines that are dashed. And These straight lines intersect in exactly 9 points. The elliptic curve by construction intersects those two other collections of three lines in exactly 8 points. Therefore, by a dimension count, it has intersected in 9 points. And the fact that that 9th point of intersection is a common intersection of all three curves tells you that the group law is associative, because the sum in both ways is, on the one hand, on one of the cubic, the union of three lines viewed as a cubic, and on the other hand, is on the other union of three lines viewed as a cubic. So it's a geometry construction that amounts to some sort of dimension counting argument. And if you don't understand that, I encourage you to look at this chapter 1 of Silverman and Tate. It's a very nice description of that. So that's the second way of thinking about the group law. It's just some geometric thing. And it does give you associativity. It's not too simple, but it's a nice argument. So it's page 21 if you want to look at this.
So let's see. So way one is your computer. Way two is geometry, which at the end it comes down to two results. One is the Zipf's theorem, and the other is a dimension count, which says that if you have two cubics intersect in 9 points, and you have a third cubic that needs 8 of those points, it'll meet the 9th as well.
And maybe I'll sketch the dimension count argument. So these two cubics are given by equations f1 of xy equal to 0 and f2 of xy equals 0. A general cubic, you just count how many coefficients you have in a general cubic. There are 10 coefficients. You can rescale them, so there's 9 degrees of freedom, really, if you allow rescaling of your coefficients. And since these intersect in 8 points, you've cut down the dimension of the space of cubics that you're considering to a one-dimensional space. You've gone from 9, then each time you impose a condition that they go through a given point, you cut down the dimension by 1. So you get down to a one-dimensional space of cubics. So
F1 and F2 are the
original two? Yes, F1 and F2 are equations that define the original two cubics. And the family of all cubics that go through 8 points is a one-dimensional family. Just because each time you say that you're going to go through a given point, you cut down the dimension of the family of cubics. So the thing you observe from that,
which you of course need to do some more work to show, is that every cubic that goes through those two points is a linear combination A1 F1 plus A2 F2. Since right here I've given a one-parameter family of cubics that goes through those 8 points
as you vary A1 and A2. So that means that this third cubic that goes to those 8 points has to be a linear combination of F1 and F2. Since there's a one-parameter family of cubics that go through that point, and here it is. But notice that this cubic will vanish at the 9th point of intersection, because the 9th point of intersection is a point where both F1 and F2 are 0. So you have a common 0 for both of these, hence the sum is going to be 0. And that's why you get intersection with the 9th point. So that's the crucial input to proving the group law is associative geometrically. It's this dimension count thing. But to make the dimension count rigorous, you have to be a lot more careful than I'm being right now. So those are two viewpoints. The third viewpoint, which is my favorite, is unfortunately basically requires a lot more work. But I'll put it over here. There's a 3 here for a second. Move it over here. So here is a third way of constructing the group law on a cubic curve, the group operation on an elliptic curve. But it's has the property that it's you very clearly get a group if you can understand what the objects are in the construction. That's the problem. And then after you understand them, you could then subsequently prove that the group operation is the same as what I gave you here. It's very natural, and it's really completely analogous to how you construct, say, the class group of a number field, where you have ideal classes, modulo principal ideals. It's exactly the analog. It is, in fact, completely analogous to that. What we're doing where we have explicit points, it's kind of like composition of binary quadratic forms, in the sense of Gauss. So it gets a lot more formulaic. So here's the third description. You identify E of K with what are called divisors of degree zero on E over K, modulo principal divisors of degree zero on E over K. And this is an abelian group. This other thing is a subgroup. And you have a sort of natural bijection between the two. So that gives E of K group structure. And then you find it's the same group structure as what I defined already. But the problem is, what is div zero of E and what is principal? What are the principal divisors? You have a question?
The Picard group?
Yes, this is also known as the Picard group. In the case, for I mean, there's this is pick zero. Pick zero is actually something slightly different, but canonically isomorphic to this. So I think the divisor group is pretty easy to define. It's the set of all formal sums . So these are formal sums of points on the curve. And the condition is, you have to be careful here. I'm going to, for simplicity, I'll assume that K is algebraically closed. But this works fine even when it isn't. So you take all formal sums of elements of E of K. So
you might say I've cheated. I mean, I can't define the divisors in terms of summing points because I'm trying to define summing points. This is a completely different meaning of summing the points. This is just a formal sum where you just take your favorite random collection of points on the curve and assign some integer coefficients.
Good A sub n are integers. And then you just take that formal linear combination. It seems complicated, but actually it has very little information in it. It's a fairly simple construction. All I'm doing is, say, taking whatever random points I want in the curve with various multiplicities together, and then I take all such things and I get some object. It's a set of all such things. It's actually an additive abelian group. It's not finitely generated. It has infinitely many generators. The generators are the elements of the infinite. Questions or comments? Yes, please.
It's actually div, not div zero. Just so
you can this is div, you're right. Div zero is what I want here.
Yeah.
To make div, let me include the additional condition that the sum of the a sub n is equal to zero. Thank you. So this is div zero. And this is called the group of divisors on the curve. Then the subgroup of principal divisors on E. Well, there's a way of constructing a divisor given a rational function on the curve. So you take all divisors you get from rational functions. So what this construction is, all it is you take, if your curve is given by y squared equals x cubed plus ax plus b, the field of rational functions is simply all algebraic expressions in x and y, such as x to the 17th plus x over y cubed. That would be an element of the field of rational functions. So this field of rational functions is the field generated by x and y, subject to the relation that that y squared is equal to x cubed plus ax plus b. And the divisor associated to a function, it's one of these where you assign the coefficient to be the order of vanishing of the function at that point. So it's the sum of the zeros of the function counted with multiplicities minus the sum of the poles, that is where the function is infinity, counted with multiplicities. That gives you the divisor. So given a function, you get a divisor. And I want to take only the non-zero functions and then throw in zero. So you get a subgroup of the divisors. And if you take the quotient, then that gives you a group that is naturally the same thing as e of k. The way the map works is as follows. Given an element of e of k, say p, you map it to the divisor p minus the point of infinity. Put brackets here to remind us that this isn't the usual addition on the group. This is a divisor of degree zero. And you can show that every single element over here is of this form. So you get a surjective map in this direction. And the kernel, let's see, there's no actual kernel. It's an isomorphism. So in other words, you show that this is not the divisor of a function. If this were the divisor of a function, then that function would define an isomorphism between the elliptic curve and a line, which is not possible. So this is the third, more abstract way of defining a group structure on an elliptic curve. You introduce the notion of divisors of degree zero and principal divisors, and then you find that your elliptic curve that maps to this quotient, and the map is surjective and injective. The fact that it's surjective is the most difficult part of this, and is a consequence of the Riemann-Roch theorem, which is a non-trivial theorem. So. So don't, if you're an undergraduate and you didn't understand this part, don't worry at all. So that's mainly for the grad students. But one and two, I mean, certainly understand that you could do this on a computer if you were crazy, and this geometry is a nice sort of thing. Okay, so, and then that's three. One interesting thing about this construction is it makes sense even if your elliptic curve if you replace your elliptic curve by a curve of higher degree, instead of a cubic curve, a curve of degree 4 or degree 5, the degree is just the biggest exponent that appears in the sum of the biggest exponents that appears in any term of the equation. So, for example, you could put x to the n plus y to the n equals 1. That's a curve of degree n, and you can consider this quotient for that curve of degree n. It turns out that you don't get an isomorphism, but you still get injectivity. If you can find some point on the curve that has coordinates in k, and since we're assuming k is algebraically closed, you can, then you get a map from, I'll call my curve c, you get a map from the points on c into, and the definitions here are identical, into div 0 of the curve, module, the principal, divisors on the curve. In general, though, when c has degree bigger than 3, this will not be injective. I'm sorry, it will not be surjective. So not surjective in general. In fact, the only time when it's surjective is when you have an elliptic curve. Or, well, if the curve has degree 2 or 1, then it's also surjective, but then it's not injective. So for degree bigger than 3, non-singular curve, you have it mapped like this, and it's not surjective, ever. You do still have a group, though. There's a group right here. And in fact, you can take two points on the curve, so p and q, you can map them over here and add them together here. And the resulting sum, there's no reason it should be in the image of the curve. So you don't get a group operation on the curve itself. However, an amazing fact which was proved by Vey is that this group is the set of solutions to some algebraic equations. And that collection of algebraic equations, they define something called the Jacobian of the curve. So the Jacobian, it's something given by algebraic equations. It's an algebraic variety. It has a group structure on it coming from the group here. And it's the natural place in which to add together points that are on a curve of higher degree. So that's just a quick aside. That's where the Jacobian comes from. Elliptic curves are the unique case, if you look at curves, where projective curves are the unique degree curves for which you can put a group structure on the curve. For higher degree, you don't get a group structure. For lower degree, you don't either. Everything degenerates. So that is the group. All right, questions? We're now done talking about the definition of the group on an elliptic curve. Yes, please.
The special cases.
Okay. That's a good idea. Let's come back to one of them and see what goes wrong. Let's try, as we made it, put a group structure on one of the degenerate curves and see what goes wrong. That's a great idea. I forgot about that.
Not when the points are equal or when...
Oh, that's another thing. Okay. You meant the degenerate cases and the definition of the group structure.
Yeah.
So what do you want to know about them? What should I say?
So it's when the points are equal with 1. What's P1 plus P1?
Oh, okay. So P1 plus P1, you draw... It's just a limiting case. You draw the tangent line. And then the other point of intersection, you get it, and then you reflect. So that's what you do in the limiting case where P1 is equal to P2. You draw the tangent line at the point P1,
okay,
which is exactly the limit if you view P1 getting closer and closer to, or P2 getting closer and closer to P1. But I have a feeling I'm not satisfying your question.
Oh, no, that's
okay.
Fine.
Yeah. Also, if you want to rigorously prove that the group operation is associative, then you have to worry about those special cases. Although you can use a continuity argument to deal with them. So actually, you don't have to worry about them. But in order to use the continuity argument, you have to know a lot. And if you knew enough to use the continuity argument, you'd probably be able to define the group structure this way, and then you don't have to worry about these limiting cases and so on. Yes?
I'm seeing a degenerate case with the group structure.
Yeah, let's do that. That's a good idea. So let's just choose a specific equation. Y squared equals x cubed. Okay? Does this define an elliptic curve? No. Because the discriminant that I wrote down before for this particular curve, so here a and b are both 0, what's the discriminant? It's just 0, because before the discriminant was some polynomial a and b, so it has to be 0. So we have this degenerate case, and let's graph it. So when x is negative, it's negative, so you're not going to see anything in this real graph on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, though, you'll see somehow the square root of y equals x cubed. So this is what it roughly looks like. So let's try to use the group operation as I defined it earlier via formulas and see what goes wrong. Again, the point at infinity up here is supposed to be the neutral element of the group. So let's try some fairly nice point here. You actually do get a group if you stay away from this bad point, so we better try the bad point. Okay, so let's try to add the bad point to to itself. There's a really bad point here. You try to add the bad point to itself. You draw this horizontal line, and you look at the other, so it's the tangent line, and you find the other point of intersection, which is this point yet again. And now you reflect about the x-axis, so you get this point again. So this point plus itself is equal to itself. I call that point P. P plus P is equal to P. Which, in an abelian group, would tell me that P is the identity element. But it's not the identity element, because we have the identity element up here, which also has the property that when you add it to itself, you get back itself. So you have two identity elements, which is kind of bad. So that's one thing that goes wrong with getting a group. However, if you avoid this one bad point, you do get a group, and that group is, in a nice way, isomorphic to the additive group of your field. So let's see how that works. I think you can parameterize this equation, y squared equals x cubed,
one.
I think you can parameterize it in terms of a single variable t.
Any ideas? I just want a formula that gives me all the points on here except the point 0, 0.
So there's going to be a t in the denominator. Ideas? That works, but then I think it misses the point in infinity. But if I so if I choose any non-zero t, then do I have this backwards? Backwards. Yeah. If I choose any non-zero t and let x be 1 over t squared and y be 1 over t cubed, then it satisfies this equation. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between non-zero t and points on this curve except the point at the origin. And then t equal to 0 should correspond to the point at infinity. So if you set up that correspondence, I think you get a group isomorphism between the points on this curve minus the point at the origin and the numbers t under addition. So let's see if that really works.
We have formulas for what the group operation should be, so let's try taking two points and then adding them together. So you can take t1 and t2. They define two points. So our points are p1 equals 1 over t1 squared 1 over t1 cubed, and p2 equals 1 over t2 squared comma 1 over t2 cubed.
And the question is, if we add these two together using this coordinate tangent procedure, what third point do we get? And then write it in terms of t1 and t2, and hopefully we'll get something like, I think we end up getting, based purely on memory, of 1 over t1 plus t2 quantity squared, etc. So, do you see the problem? What do we have to try to do? So if I'm parameterizing the points here by these two values, by one value, t, that gives me points on this curve, and I want to add together two of them. So, I mean, you can do like we did before. If you have p1 and p2, you can take, as long as none of them involve the point 0, 0, you can take the third point of the intersection and reflect it, you get a point here, which is p3. The sum in the group operation of p1 and p2.
So the question is, what is that in terms of coordinates, in terms of the formula? And let's see.
Can we just use the formulas we used before, or do we have to derive it from scratch? I think we can just use the formulas from before. So let's just assume that t1 is not equal to t2, so that these points are different, and then lambda is y1 minus y2, so 1 over t1 cubed minus 1 over t2 cubed over 1 over t1 squared minus 1 over t2 squared, x1 minus x2. And then the third point, which I'm denoting p3 here, it has x coordinate, which is lambda squared. We should probably try to simplify this by multiplying top and bottom by really t1 cubed, t2 cubed. T2 cubed minus t1 cubed. And multiplying top and bottom by t1 cubed, t2 cubed. Divided by t1 t2 cubed minus
T2T2T2. Okay, so P3 is now lambda squared. Complicated. Minus x1, which is 1 over t1 squared, minus x2, which is 1 over t2 squared. Whatever it is there.
So now the algebra gets unpleasant. The points besides this point parameterize the additive group. So,
if you instead consider the other case, y squared equals x, say x minus 1 squared, as an example, then if you take the points minus this one, you get the multiplicative group.
Again, you have a similar procedure. I'm not going to go through the algebra here
because it's getting messy. And
There must be some conceptual way to do it without doing the algebra that isn't occurring to me, unfortunately. Okay, so we'll start right at the beginning next time with Lenstra's elliptic curve method for factoring integers using elliptic curves. So that'll be the first thing at the beginning next time. Okay? And again, I'll have office hours tomorrow from 3 to 5 in my office. Also, I have business cards, so if you want one, I just got them today. I have my office number in the house. Thanks. Did you feel less lost today than last week?
Yeah, for sure.
Excellent.
Less lost.
There are a few things I did that weren't, were just throwing out there. But what did you not get or get?
When you were explaining the third method of.
That. I mean, it really, you have to set up a systematic theory, and it's very, very algebraic. There's divisors and principal divisors. That's sort of bizarre if you. See you later. It's strange to consider that you consider an abelian group that's all linear combinations of points on the curve, where there's no, it's just formal linear combinations of points on the curve.
So an element of the group is 7 times one point plus 13 times another point plus 5 times another point. And that's it. I mean, you don't reduce them in any way. It's very simple. There's like nothing there. I mean, you can't. There's no like addition or anything. It's just formally you take copies. You take some number of copies of one point plus some number of copies of another point. Does that make sense? You can do that for anything in math. You can take any mathematical object at all, any set of any sort, and you can take the so-called free abelian group on the elements of that set. And that's all formal linear combinations of the elements of that set.
Sorry.
Integer coefficients.
Okay.
It's bizarre though, isn't it?
It is. Also, you mentioned earlier, I'm not sure about finite fields.
Yes.
Fields, and so I don't know what you're talking about there.
Right. So, let's see. So a field is, and I give a whole bunch of examples
right.
of fields. A finite, so if you knew what a field was, then a finite field would be a field that happens as a set to be finite. That's all.
Okay.
It's not something more complicated.
Right.
You could use what?
Does it have to be? Okay.
Yeah, it's not count. I mean, it's better than countable. It's finite.
No. Okay.
Cardinality is just finite. There's just some finite list of elements. You can write them all down. And it's not a priori the case that in algebra something called finite just means that it's finite as a set. But in this particular instance, it is. So then the question is, what is a field? And the answer is that a field is it's a collection of elements that have an addition operation on them and a multiplication operation on them, like a ring.
Isn't that what the definition of a group is, that it has?
Well, a group has just
has
a single
one of the binary, right.
Yeah, it has a binary operation. A field, well, it's probably better to define a ring first. A field is just a special type of ring. But a ring is a set, R, where you have a plus and a times. They have two different operations. And then you require that, one thing is that the ring under addition forms a group. That you have the distributive law, A times B plus B is A times B plus A times B. And the multiplicative thing should be associative. So A, B, C is equal to A, B, C. And just a couple of natural axioms. That gives you a ring. There's also supposed to be a one-hole ring in it usually. That when you multiply by anything, you get back that thing. So it's just a list of axioms that you notice are common to every example I wrote down up here. And the distinction that makes a ring a field is just one thing. It's that if you take the non-zero elements of the object under multiplication, that also gives you a group.
Could you repeat that again?
If you take the non-zero elements of your ring under multiplication and you get a group, then that's a field.
Okay.
That's what a field is. For example, if you take the integers, then under addition and multiplication, usual addition and multiplication, that's a ring. And now suppose you take the non-zero integers. That's z, and then you leave out zero element. And then you consider that under multiplication. Does that form a group? Does it have inverses, identity, etc., closure?
I think so.
But what about inverses? What would be the inverse of 2?
Is that you can't have a negative one.
Yeah, well, negatives don't work because it's multiplication. So it's I'm considering this set with this binary operation. And the only one of the integers would be the identity element, but you don't have multiplicative inverses. So this is not a field. Whereas if you take Q, the rational numbers, under addition and multiplication, then the non-zero element is Q minus zero. That is a group under multiplication. Because each element has an inverse, a multiplicative inverse.
Okay.
So let's see. What if you take the integers modulo p? So these are the numbers 0, 1, 2, up through p minus 1. When you add two of them together, you add them, then you take the remainder upon division by p and get the result. That's addition. Multiplication is you multiply the two numbers. If the result is bigger than or equal to p, again, you divide the result by p and get the remainder, and then that gives you something to set again. So this is a ring. And the moment I change the p to n, just an arbitrary positive integer, it's a ring, and it may or may not be a field depending on n. For some values of n, if you take this ring and then take the non-zero elements under multiplication, for some values of n, you do get a group, and for other values of n, you don't, as it turns out. And that reflects the fact that sometimes this is a field and sometimes it isn't, depending on n. It will be a field exactly when n is prime. If n is prime, then the non-zero elements each have inverses, and you get a field. When n is composite, there will be non-zero elements that don't have inverses, so you don't get a field.
Okay.
And it's a really useful construction, this ring z minus integers from 0 to n minus 1. So, this divide and take the remainder is not a very good way of describing it. A better way to think about it is like this. So, you have all of the integers. Say n is 6. Now let's just imagine that you're allowed to say, you define an equivalence relation on the integers by saying two integers are equivalent if you can get from one to the other by moving 6 places. You're allowed to sort of jump for free by 6 places, and you can get from anything to anything else. So for example, then every single number would be equivalent to one between 0 and 5. For example, minus 2, if you're allowed to move 6 positions for free, what is minus 2 equivalent to?
4.
What do you get to? You get to 4.
It's just like, is it kind of like mod 6?
Yeah, okay. It's exactly mod 6. So here you can take two numbers and multiply them, like 2 times 4, you multiply them and you get 8. That will be, if you're allowed to move by 6, that will be equivalent to exactly one thing here. What will it be equivalent to?
2.
2. So 2 times 4 is equal to 2. Modulo 6. So z mod 6z, this is a ring. The addition is just addition modulo 6. The multiplication is multiplication modulo 6. And the question is this a field? That is to say, if you take the non-zero elements under multiplication, do you get a field? I mean, sorry, do you get a group? Is this a group? So here we're taking the numbers 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and then multiplication is multiplication modulo 6. Is that a group? Is it closed, for example?
Multiplication would work, wouldn't it?
Because am I or am I not?
If you're just multiplying those numbers within those sets, right?
That's right.
And if you take that modulo 6.
If you take any two numbers in here and multiply them, do you get something in here again? One of the properties of a group is closure.
Okay.
So if you take two numbers in here and multiply the modulo 6, do you get something in there again?
Yes.
Are you sure?
Oh, there's no 0.
Yeah, there's no 0.
So watch out. So if it feels 3 times 2,
that's right.
Then
you get taken out of the set. So it's not a group because it's not even closed into this operation. Therefore, this is not a field. And notice what went wrong here. 2 and 3, those are the factors of 6. 6 is composite. If 6 were prime, you wouldn't have been able to pull that trick. You would have, you wouldn't have been able to get out of the set by multiplying together elements in the set.
Okay, so if it was mod 7, then that would be a field.
That's right.
Okay.
Yeah. And you get all the fields of order prime, whose cardinality is a prime number via this construction, z mod pz. That gives you all fields of prime order. Then you can worry about, there are also fields of prime power order. For example, there's a field of order 4. Up to isomorphism, there's a unique field of order 4. And in general, you have finite fields of all prime power cardinality. So there's no finite field of order 6, but there is a finite field of order 4 or 8 or 9 or whatever. So
So you can have composite cardinality. So this field is not.
This is not Zmod force. I'm confused. This is not a field. It's just like what you did here,
except you take 2 times 2 and it gets you something out of the set of non-zero elements, because 2 times 2 is 0.
But there is still a field of order 4.
Some work to construct it, but you can construct a field of order 4. But you consider, it's kind of like the complex numbers, actually.
So to make a field of order 4, you start with Z mod 2Z, which is a field, because 2 is prime. And then you consider instead a set of all pairs A plus B, I'll call it J, such that A and B are in Z mod 2Z. And then J, I think, satisfies the equation 1 plus J squared equals 0.
So given this, let's write it as J squared equals 1 plus J. Given that relation, you can take, of course, you can add 2 elements to this form, and you can also multiply them. If you have 2, you just multiply it all out, and then anytime you see a j squared, you replace it by 1 plus j. So it's very much like the complex numbers being viewed as pairs a, b, or as formal sums a plus bi, where you have some multiplication rule on these. So you can also construct a field of order 4,
which is called F4,
and it's all formal sums A plus BJ, where the multiplication just comes from using this relation. And the addition is just component-wise addition. So it's very, maybe I'll even call it I, so it seems even more like the complex numbers. Except instead of I squared being minus 1, I squared is 1 plus I. So it's slightly different. But you just take that collection of objects and then you can verify that it does form a field and it has cardinality 4 because the elements of this thing are 0, 1, I, 4, and 1 plus I. And you can write down the the way that any 2 elements multiply together. You get a third element.
Okay.
So in general, you have fields f, p to the n for any prime number p and any integer n. It's it's some work to construct these things, and it's a major research area in computer science, actually, is thinking about ways of efficiently doing arithmetic in fields like this. So people published a lot of papers on that. Let's see. So these are examples of fields like this and this. The other big class of fields that you have are number fields. These are, what you do is you take the rational numbers, and then you take any root at all of some polynomial with coefficients in the rational numbers. So if this is a polynomial with coefficients in Q, and you take a root alpha of this. So you take an alpha, which is a complex number, such that f of alpha is 0. And then what you do is you consider the field K, which is Q joint alpha. And this is, by definition, all sums A sub n alpha at the n, where A sub n is a rational number. These aren't formal sums, this is just a subset of the complex numbers. It's the smallest thing you get by taking the rational numbers and alpha together in the complex numbers and allowing all multiplications and additions between these things. A special case of this is alpha equals I. Squared of minus 1, that satisfies f equals x squared plus 1. It's a root of that polynomial. And then here you get the Gaussian rational numbers, if you like. You get all things in the form a plus bi. But you can do this for absolutely any root of any polynomial. And when you do this, you get a whole bunch of different fields. And they're called number fields. This is a number field. The name number field may seem completely stupid because, I mean, it's a field that has numbers in it. But the consideration of these fields in the very late 1800s, it really started with people thinking about Fermat's Last Theorem. And I think in those times, this was the only example, really, of a field that
people thought about it so much. It was kind of a sort of an abstract version of the fields. But then it was the example of a field of numbers that was just called a number field. You could argue that any field should be called a number field. It's a field that has numbers in it, but these are the ones that were considered first long ago. So they get that special distinction. They're fields that you get via this construction. You take any polynomial, take any root of that polynomial, but any polynomial with coefficients in Q. This notation means the collection of all polynomials, such that the coefficients are rational numbers, and take any of them, take any one of them, and then you take any root of that polynomial, and then you just take all sums, you know, all algebraic expressions you get from that root, and you get a field.
And an is just a
rational.
Just a rational constant.
Yep.
Okay.
You can vary over all possibilities. You vary. See, this is a set of all possible sums of this form for all possibilities for a base. So it's just all. It's all things you get by adding and multiplying alpha with itself and any rational number.
It's kind of making a little bit more sense now.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Again, an example of this is Q adjoining square root minus 1. And this is a number field. And its elements turn out to be things that form A plus B square root minus 1. But this is just an I, for A and B are rational numbers. And if you do the algebra, if you multiply something of this form by something else of this form, you find that it's again of that form. Because of the relation that root minus 1 satisfies.
Are you saying that if you multiply that by something of that form, it's mm-hmm. going to be irrational, or is it just
no,
going to be of that
form? No, it'll be of this form again. Oh, just okay. That it's of this form again.
Of the so, A plus B, yeah. I form. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, maybe it would be equal to 0, possibly. But it's still of that form.
Okay.
So you get a field. There's tons and tons of fields. And the neat thing with elliptic curves is you write down one elliptic curve, say y squared equals x cubed minus x, then you can consider the group of points on that elliptic curve where the points have coordinates in a specific field. And you can choose, there's millions, infinitely many different fields you can consider. So you get a natural family of different groups, all finitely generated abelian groups. And just trying to understand that collection of groups is a very interesting question. For example, for this particular curve, understanding the groups that you get as you vary the field over fields, kind of in this form, except you place minus 1 by d. So just the square root of some number. Let's say, integer. As you vary over all fields like this, and look at the group of points on this curve over these various fields, you get a whole bunch of different finitely generated abelian groups. And the structure of that collection of groups is very mysterious, but very interesting. It's closely related to the congruent number problem, which the congruent number problem is the following. Here's a problem. Write a program that takes input an integer, and outputs either yes or no. Yes, there's a right triangle, all of whose side lengths are rational. So A, B, and C, these are all rational. And the area of that right triangle is equal to the number I gave you. Or another, there's no such triangle. So for example, if I give you the number 1, there's no way you'll ever find a right triangle. All three of whose side lengths are rational, whose area is 1. It's a non-trivial thing, but you can show that. But there's a problem that's about 1,000 years old, which is you give a number n, and you have to say either yes, it's the area of a right triangle with rational sides, or no, it isn't. And it's still an unsolved problem to give a procedure that's guaranteed to terminate that will tell you either yes or no. But deciding that is, as it turns out, equivalent to understanding this particular curve, but over various fields. And I don't quite have it yet.